Now, the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court came out last month. It's once again changed recognition of sovereignty of Native American tribes. You're listening to The Morning Show, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And Justice Amy Coney Barrett was not on the court when they reestablished Native sovereignty just 2 years ago, and her addition may signal a shift in how the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court treats the rights of our First Nations. Up next for the court, it has announced that the justices will be going back to decide the fate of the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act. So, what's the future hold for Native American rights and remaining Native American lands? You share your perspective at 1-800-642-1234 or 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut, co-author and member of the editorial board of Felix S. Cohn's Handbook of Federal Indian Law, and co-author of leading case books in both property law and American Indian law. Bethany Berger, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
So this decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last month about Native American sovereignty, in the big picture, how do you view the new legal landscape that's facing our First Nations?
Well, it's a mixed picture. This decision was a huge blow, and it suggests that the Supreme Court now is willing to overturn principles that have been established for hundreds of years. So that is very disturbing. With respect to the legal landscape generally, tribes are exercising their rights more effectively than they have in the past, and Congress is more receptive to self-determination in the courts. So while in the Supreme Court it looks bad, the general landscape is mixed.
So as an expert on federal and Native law, are you being asked to provide guidance for tribes, their attorneys, on what this new legal landscape looks like?
So I've been taught, you know, I wrote a amicus brief in the Castro Huerta case, the most recent case. And so I'm still involved with the groups that are working with this. And we're all putting our heads together to figure out what can be done next to preserve the rights that tribes have worked so hard for.
And you say that this case, the 5-4 decision from last month, is upending precedent from hundreds of years, but doesn't it just upend the decision from just a couple years ago when Justice Gorsuch was in the majority, writing the majority decision?
No, that's the irony. Huh. So in 2020, the Supreme Court decided McGirt v. Oklahoma, which established that basically the eastern half of Oklahoma was part of five different tribal reservations, that reservations established by treaty back in the 1830s hadn't been destroyed. And since then, Oklahoma has filed more than 40 petitions in the Supreme Court trying to get McGirt overturned. And the court has refused to take any of those petitions. But in Castro Huerta, they took the second half of one of those petitions that said, can the state exercise criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians committing crimes against Indians on reservations? And that's the side they took, the question they took, and five of the justices said they could. And that is what, since the founding of the United States, everyone, courts, legislatures, prosecutors, has understood that states don't have that jurisdiction. That's what the court reversed.
So they do now under the Supreme Court decision. So what is it about this decision, Bethany Berger, that is a departure from how crimes on reservations have been handled historically?
So historically, when the crime involved an Indian, either as a victim or as the defendant, only the federal government or the tribal government had jurisdiction. For a state to have that jurisdiction, you needed congressional consent, really specific congressional consent. And Congress acted on that understanding in 1790, in 1834, in 1948, in 1953. It just kept on enacting statutes based on this understanding. And the Supreme Court said, nope, when the defendant is a non-Indian and the victim is an Indian, the state can prosecute them.
So I know you're a law professor at the University of Connecticut, but I would ask what you know about Wisconsin, our 11 federally recognized tribes that reside here, and how this decision could impact them, Bethany.
Well, so most of the tribes in Wisconsin are covered by a 1953 law called Public Law 280. So that's one of the places where Congress gave the state that specific jurisdiction.
Okay.
Only one, I believe Menominee, is not covered by Public Law 280. And so with respect to that tribe, the decision says, yes, the state has jurisdiction, even though Congress didn't give it to you.
So this Public Law 280 means that there is already state jurisdiction in the 10 of the 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. But this decision from the Supreme Court last month, the Castro Huerta decision, may make that for all of the, including the Menominee?
Yes.
Okay. Our guest, Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut, and we invite you to join us. She's also the co-author and one of the editors of the Felix S. Cohen's Handbook of Federal Indian Law. And we're taking a look at the Supreme Court decision upending precedent that goes all the way back and what that means for Native rights, sovereign territory, and where Native American lands stand today with respect to the United States of America. If you have perspective on this from where you are, we invite you to share that at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our conversation with Bethany Berger continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Talking about Native American sovereignty following the 5-4 decision last month of the U.S. Supreme Court that changes some of that, going all the way back to precedent that dates back to the early days of this country. So our guest, Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut and an expert in Native American law, and we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question about the Supreme Court's decision and its impacts across Wisconsin, or if you have a comment about your experiences, we welcome those as well, and you can email us ideas@wpr.org. Bethany, the 2020 Federal Circuit Court decision affirmed the Oneida Tribe's reservation boundaries in northeastern Wisconsin, and you wrote and filed an argument in support of the Oneida Nation in that case. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved and what that case means for Native sovereignty?
Sure. You know, as you can tell from the McGirt case, I've been involved in questions about reservation boundaries with the Tribal Supreme Court project for a number of years. And the National Congress of American Indians was wanting to file a friend of the court brief there and asked if I could. And that case basically establishes that the boundaries of the reservation still exist. It was a conflict between Hobart and the tribe about regulation of the tribe's apple festival. And before they could even decide the question of regulation, they had to decide whether the reservation still existed. And so the court held that the reservation does still exist, which means that all the special rules around jurisdiction in Indian country apply.
Bethany, is this now dispute ended, or is there still, do you know whether or not this has been resolved, or does this dispute over boundaries continue?
This is the last word on boundaries, as far as I know. The Supreme Court has not granted certiorari on it. Congress could amend it, but I'm not aware of any effort of Congress to amend it. There are still jurisdictional questions, but at least those jurisdictional questions can start from the assumption that there is a reservation there. The alternative to a reservation is basically what we call a checkerboard area, that in order to determine jurisdiction, you have to see who owns the land. Is it owned by the tribe in trust, or is it owned by a non-Indian? And as you can imagine, that is a super difficult way to run a government.
Yes.
Now we can just say everything is part of the reservation.
We're talking about the impact of the U.S. Supreme Court decision on Native lands here in Wisconsin with Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut and an expert in Native American law. Taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, where Mike in St. Lawrence is standing by. Mike, good morning. You're on the air with Bethany Berger.
Morning. Yeah, quick question. If this is settled law for such a long, 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 long time, who brought the suit and for what reason? Why did they want to have federal prosecution on Indian lands for a non-Native Indian? Well, I don't understand what the purpose was.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. Let's clarify this. This 5-4 Supreme Court decision that came out last month, who brought the suit and for what reason, Bethany?
Sure. So Oklahoma brought the suit. Basically, the state just refuses to accept the decision that this land is part of a reservation. And since then, they've been looking for any opportunity to get that question back before the court. And basically, this was a question that they hoped to package with the reservation question to have that reheard. And instead, the Supreme Court said, we're not going to rehear the reservation question. We're just going to do this. And this came out of a criminal case involving Mr. Castro Huerta, where the state had first prosecuted him and convicted him. Then after the decision that was part of a reservation, the courts agreed that only the federal government had jurisdiction. So the federal government prosecuted and convicted him. But the state said, no, we don't care that this guy's in jail anyway. We want to use this to bring our claims back to the Supreme Court.
Well, and as I understand it, the decision last month, Bethany, all those who were in the majority in the 2020 decision, McGirt, as you mentioned, were in the minority this time around, and all those that were in the minority 2 years ago were in the majority this time around, and the only difference was the addition to the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. So what does this mean now when the High Court has consolidated four court cases together to challenge the constitutionality of the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act? What do you expect from the court in its next session on this, Bethany?
Yeah, so I am very, very worried about this. Mm. So the Indian Child Welfare Act is an extremely important law recognizing the huge rates at which Indian kids are being taken away from their families and from tribes, and trying to ensure that in child welfare cases, both the family has increased procedural rights, that the tribe has the right to try the case, and so on. And the challenge here, what makes this even more disturbing, is the challenge is not to how the statute is interpreted, is whether it's unconstitutional at all. And so the Supreme Court could hold that the statute, by treating Indians and Indian kids differently, violates equal protection. And that would cast a whole lot of Indian law statutes into question.
So this could be this 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act that will be revisited on grounds of constitutionality with our new makeup of our U.S. Supreme Court in the next their next session could be the start of something and not the end of something when it comes to Native sovereignty? You see a domino effect here or perhaps a slippery slope?
Yes. And in fact, the attorneys that initially started challenging the Indian Child Welfare Act on constitutionality, some of them got their start challenging Indian gaming and saying that was unconstitutional. or challenging, trying to whittle away at affirmative action generally, or being involved in challenging tribal control of natural resources on their reservations. So I'm very afraid that this is a vehicle to undo Indian law altogether.
Running out of time here this hour, Bethany Berger, but big picture from your experience as an expert in federal and Native American law, it sounds like there, you talk about the 40 lawsuits that we're targeting, trying to get some states' oversight over Native lands, finally getting one through the Supreme Court in the decision last month, and then the next case coming up for the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act. The big picture is, do you see, why are there so many challenges to Native sovereignty right now?
Because, I mean, there's always been challenges to Native sovereignty.
Okay.
There are always groups and individuals that don't like tribes and don't like tribal sovereignty. There have always been these challenges. The difference is that the Supreme Court is willing to hear those challenges, and that the opponents of tribal sovereignty are looking at this court and thinking this is a good moment to possibly undo the principles that they didn't like before.
I have a question here, but we're running out of time, but really quickly, Native people in Southwest Wisconsin, I'm asking about constitutionally protected burial rights in Wisconsin. What do you know about that, Bethany?
I don't know a ton about it. Native American graves, the NAGPRA, does protect tribal burials on federal and tribal land. I don't think that's under attack.
Okay.
States can also protect grave sites to ensure that people don't go digging up bones.
Bethany, we are out of time, but I want to thank you so much for sharing this story this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Bethany Berger, law professor at the University of Connecticut, co-author and member of the editorial board of the Felix S. Cohn's Handbook of Federal Indian Law, and the co-author of leading casebooks in both property law and Native American law. Just ahead on the anniversary, we've got more ahead with you this morning. Stay tuned. I'm Lee Rayburn. We're going to go to the Grill Master when we continue, and a look at some of the candidates you'll find on your slate for the August 9th primary. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.